The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Peter C. Kavanaugh presiding.
Thank you. This is 4-21-0489, People of the State of Illinois versus Trujillo. For the appellant, would you please state your name for the record?
Edward J. Wittrig on behalf of the appellant.
Thank you. And for the appellee?
Luke McNeil.
Thank you, counsel. You may proceed.
Your honors, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Edward Wittrig. I'm with the Office of the State Appellate Defender. I represent the petitioner appellant, Mr. Moises Trujillo, on this appeal. In this case, Trujillo, a young Xanax addict with a ninth grade education, and he spoke English as a second language, was kept in custody, isolated in a high-risk cell away from others, and deprived of any access to a telephone or any access to the courtroom in violation of his statutory rights. Now, during this period of intense isolation, the detectives repeatedly cursed at him, branded him a liar, and told him in no uncertain terms that he murdered Mr. Poole and robbed him, even though that theory did not match the scene of the crime. So predictably, days later, when the detectives offered Trujillo that he could have Ms. Kennedy, and Ms. Kennedy was his girlfriend that he resided in, the love of his life, released from custody, that he could finally call his mother, and he spoke to his mother every day, and could actually have a life with Ms. Kennedy if he cooperated. He understandably.
I believe there was feedback, counsel. You're fine.
Sorry about that. I didn't want to interrupt. He understandably provided the detectives with exactly what he knew they wanted to hear, and that is he shot Mr. Poole during the course of a robbery. So under the totality of these circumstances, Trujillo's will was overborne by these efforts to isolate him and deprive him of his statutory rights. The circuit court reversibly erred in finding otherwise, and this court should reverse and remand for a new trial with these statements to police suppressed. So looking at the telephone issue first, it's well established that in this state, an arrested person has a statutory right to reasonable telephone access when they're in custody. And specifically here at the time of his arrest, section 725 ILCS 5/103-3 provided that Trujillo had the right to communicate with an attorney of his choice and a member of his family by making a reasonable number of telephone calls or in any other reasonable manner. Such communication shall be permitted within a reasonable time after arrival at the first place of custody. Now, in interpreting that statute, the Illinois Supreme Court has determined that a reasonable amount of time is a really short period, such as a couple of hours. And the Illinois Supreme Court has also recognized that given this inherently coercive atmosphere that's created at a police station, extended delays in providing a suspect the means to speak with an attorney and to procure bond is going to reduce their ability to avoid the psychological pressures of a custodial detention. And that's going to increase the likelihood that a statement is involuntary. So any violation of the statute has to be considered in analyzing the totality of the circumstances.
Counsel, if I may, as it relates to other reasonable manner, why isn't the discussion that he had with Kennedy when he's allowed to speak with her, why does that not satisfy the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. First, it wasn't within the reasonable amount of time. The legislature envisioned a couple of hours, and this was outside that couple of hour framework. And that's the Illinois Supreme Court's interpretation of that statute in People v. Salomon. Additionally, the context of that conversation also has to be considered. He was just he had attempted to enter the ceiling, the drop-down ceiling into the void space but beneath the floor, and he was pulled to the ground and he was sobbing for officers to murder him and execute him. And so it wasn't really in that context, the detectives brought Ms. Kennedy in to calm him down. And so it wasn't really a time where he could rationally discuss obtaining legal representation or procuring bond. And even more importantly, at the time he gave his statement, he no longer had telephone access and Kennedy was actually in custody. So when he when he believed that, excuse me, the detective specifically told him that she was in custody and her release depended on him. And so when he's giving this statement, he can't believe that she'll be of any help to him and that actually her release depends on him. And then, and I think it's also importantly regarding the telephone access issue, is the detectives were intentionally preventing him from having telephone access. At the motion to suppress hearing, the detectives provided that Mr. Ragsdale was a co-defendant and he hadn't been apprehended at the time. And so that was some justification for depriving Mr. Trujillo of telephone access. But immediately after he gave Trujillo, immediately after Trujillo gave his statements to police, the detectives allowed him to call his mother, to call his brother, to call his girlfriend. And this is even though Ragsdale was not apprehended until a month later. And again, his access within the jail was restored. His telephone access within the jail was restored as well. And so that was clearly just a pretext. And actually, Flynn offered the real reason he was preventing. And this is lead investigator, Detective Flynn. The real reason he was preventing Trujillo from using the phone, and that's, quote, "I'm not going to let him make any phone call, but if he cooperates, I would let him make a phone call." So taking Detective Flynn's own words here, Trujillo's statutory right to telephone access and thus to obtain legal representation, try to coordinate efforts to procure money for bond, to inform others about his current whereabouts and status and condition and needs. All of this was premised on providing the detectives with a statement that they would accept. And so in conjunction with this denial of telephone access, this court should also consider the length of the detention. So from his arrest in both the length and the manner of the detention, from his arrest on March 1st, 2017, until he's finally brought before the court on March 27th, 2017, he was largely kept alone and isolated in a high-risk cell. And so—
But counsel, there was a probable cause hearing that was held, albeit ex parte, on the criminal damage charge, isn't that correct? And then a new bond was set?
Yes, Your Honor. There is no contention here that he was unlawfully detained. He was lawfully detained. But the appellate court in People v. Suggs, and that's cited in the opening brief, does recognize that a lengthy time between being arrested and actually appearing before the court, being presented to the court, can cut against the voluntariness of a statement, even if it is a lawful detention. Although admittedly, that decision makes it clear that it slightly cuts against the voluntariness. So this court should consider the denial of access to the court in conjunction with all these other factors as well.
Thank you.
Regarding the delay in being presented to the circuit court, the circuit court here rejected that claim because of Trujillo's purported escape attempt. So I blame Trujillo's own conduct on any delay that was caused in this case. But the circuit court in that process overlooked that Trujillo was transported to the hospital for maybe an hour to an hour and a half before he was returned to police custody. And so there was And so that delay was very minimal. And he wasn't such an escape risk that the police or detectives felt they had to remain in jail. He was still transported to the interrogation room. And so there's no reason he couldn't be transported to the courtroom. And actually, the more likely cause of Trujillo's delay here before he appeared on the warrant was Detective Flynn's admission that suspects are sometimes withheld from court when the officers are still working on the case. And to that point, Trujillo clearly believed that the detectives controlled his access to the courts. He was kept alone, isolated from all others, except when the detectives would bring him to the interrogation room. And so it conveyed to him that the detectives actually controlled the circumstances of his confinement. And it also rendered him then more susceptible to the officers' efforts to provide an extrajudicial statement that matched what they were wanting to hear. And so in conjunction with this isolation and with this denial of the right to telephone, it was also very clear on the record that Trujillo was a Xanax user. He admitted the extent of his Xanax usage during these interrogations. There were also jail records from a past experience that documented his Xanax usage. And the detectives also spoke with Ms. Kennedy as well about his Xanax usage. And so the record is very clear that there's no question at that time Trujillo depended on Xanax and that his arrest immediately stopped his ability to obtain and use it. Now, the circuit court rejected that Trujillo was under the influence or withdrawing from Xanax because during the interview, he answered questions appropriately and he didn't appear to manifest any symptoms of withdrawing that would interfere with his responses. But I am arguing specifically here that finding was against the manifest weight of the evidence.
What evidence was there that really supports that the withdrawal impacted the voluntariness of those statements? What evidence was presented?
So Trujillo, besides his testimony, obviously, he also presented medical records from the jail that he was prescribed Librium by the doctors and Librium combats the effects of the withdrawal that he was experiencing. And so he was at least manifesting enough of effect that the doctors felt compelled to prescribe this medication. And then also on March 25th, 2017, which is admittedly 2 days after the first admissions, he was brought to the hospital when he was found non-responsive in his cell by emergency medical services. And so I asked this court to also consider his addiction and withdrawal in combination with this isolation and denial of his right to telephone and court access in the totality of the circumstances test as well. And moving on to my final point here regarding the interrogations, the detectives made certain promises to Trujillo, and these were made when he was in a very fragile and susceptible state. And all this contributed to overcoming his will and rendering these statements involuntary. So first, Detective Flynn led Trujillo to falsely believe that Ms. Kennedy was in custody as a result of him. And again, this is Kennedy, the love of his life, his longstanding girlfriend, and they've been together for quite a while. And so Trujillo specifically asked Flynn if she would be released if he talked with the officers, and Flynn informed him that it all depended on him. And so this would relay to Trujillo that he could actually obtain her release in exchange for providing a statement. And then the detectives further expressly promised that they would no longer interfere with the statutory right to have telephone access if he provided a statement. And so that was an explicit condition on explicit benefit, that he could receive for providing the officer or the detectives with what they wanted to hear. And then finally, the detectives also stated that to have a life with Kennedy and to see her, Trujillo would need to tell the truth. And Trujillo knew what the detectives meant by telling the truth. They had frequently accused him of murdering Mr. Poole. And so especially in the context where they had explained different levels of charges previously, this would indicate to him that he could obtain some leniency in his case and avoid life in prison if he gave him the statement. Under the entirety of these circumstances, the detectives kept Trujillo, a known Xanax addict suffering and withdrawal, in isolation for multiple days, away from access to counsel, to court, to family support. And then they conditioned access to a telephone and his girlfriend's release on a confession, and as well as promised a degree of leniency. And so all these factors contributed together to overcome his will, and he gave the detectives a statement that they wanted. In finding otherwise, the circuit court erred, and this court should find that his statements to police were not voluntary. And this improper denial mattered in this case specifically, and no harmless error analysis should be applied. Without Trujillo's admissions, there's very little here from the scene of the crime to suggest that Trujillo shot Mr. Poole during an armed robbery rather than just being a tragic shooting that occurred during a physical altercation with no robbery attempt. For instance, there were many objects in plain view that were not taken from the scene of the crime after the shooting, and this ranged from televisions, gaming systems, video games, expensive shoes.
Counsel, may I interrupt since the time is going very quickly, and I had a question regarding your argument on the Krenkel hearing. You argue that the Krenkel hearing really was inadequate, and you also tie that to ineffective assistance of counsel for not raising the corpus delicti argument. My question to you is really, didn't the trial court here in conducting that hearing allow the defendant to raise any and all issues that he wanted to? And in fact, didn't he raise this issue himself when he talked about the insufficiency of the evidence?
No, Your Honor. In the context of the insufficiency claim, he didn't specifically address corpus delicti.
Well, he didn't use those words, but I mean, the gist of his argument was that. And again, the trial court certainly didn't limit what the defendant could discuss.
Yes, Your Honor. He clearly did not limit what he could discuss. But my argument here is that once it is raised, once the specific ineffective assistance of counsel claim is raised in a written motion, the circuit court has to specifically address it. And my argument here is that the record isn't clear that claim was being addressed. Returning briefly to the evidence in this case, there was cash left at the scene of the crime, which again is inconsistent with a armed robbery. There was cash strewn about the floor in plain view. There was cash in Mr. Poole's pocket. I believe it amounted to $354. There was also money in his roommate's room that exceeded, I believe, $1,000. And there was also here factors that supported Trujillo's trial testimony that he needed to use force to defend himself from Mr. Poole. Trujillo was around 50 pounds smaller than Poole, and it was known to him specifically that Poole kept firearms. And Trujillo sustained lacerations during this encounter. Multiple witnesses explained that he was bloodied in the aftermath of the shooting. And so without these extrajudicial statements, the state's main corroborating evidence here that a robbery occurred rather than this just being a cannabis sale gone awry was co-defendants Rosa's statements to police. However, his trial...
Counsel, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt again because
yes, of course.
I'm watching the clock here and we haven't touched at all on the sentencing issues. One of your arguments is that the trial court made an error by imposing the 25-year firearm enhancement to the sentence for first-degree murder. And because that's a factor inherent in defendant's conviction for armed robbery, there was a double enhancement. But isn't it a fact that the legislature has indicated that these are two separate enhancements that can be added or two separate enhancements, that's correct, the 25-year to life sentencing can be added to each of the convictions? Isn't that clear in the statutes?
Your Honor, and I will first acknowledge that the legislature does have the power to permit double enhancements if it clearly elects to do so. My argument here in this case is that it didn't intend for both enhancements to be added when there is a total aggregate sentence and it penalizes, it imposes this 25-year to life enhancement twice within the aggregate sentence.
And your authority for that last point that you just made is what case?
And I will acknowledge there is very little case law on this specific issue, and I am relying on an extension. There is no specific case that I have, and I'm arguing for an extension of kind of analogous cases, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And so I see that my time is about up, and I would just argue that this court reverse and remand Mr. Trujillo's convictions and remand for a new trial where the evidence of his statements to detectives are suppressed. And I will stand on the briefing for arguments 2, 3, and 4, unless there are any other questions in rebuttal. Thank you.
I see none. Thank you. Mr. McNeil.
May it please the court, counsel. As for the first argument, the voluntary confession argument, we do look at the totality of the circumstances. Defendant here was allowed to physically see his girlfriend minutes after trying to escape through the ceiling of the interrogation room. And this was before he confessed. Clearly a reasonable person in defendant's position at that point, doing about the worst thing you can do in an interrogation room and then being allowed to see his longtime girlfriend. A person in defendant's position would not think that a confession was needed before further contact with that girlfriend, as he was already allowed to see her. And again, about the phone access, that the record refutes that. Defendant called his girlfriend again that night after that first interrogation, and they arranged or tried to obtain bail money. This was prior to any confession, so. The next time defendant did talk to police was a couple days later, and he was in a high-risk cell. That was of his own doing, though. He tried to escape, and then on top of that, asked the police to kill him right after that. So the reason he was in a high-risk cell was not to isolate him from the world or get him to confess. It was because he needed to be in a high-risk cell. And in fact, if he wasn't, I'm sure we'd be arguing that point on this appeal instead. At that second interview, after receiving proper Miranda warnings again, defendant confesses to the murder within an hour of the interview starting. 2 days later, defendant requests to talk to the police again, and again confesses within an hour of the interview starting. Even going back to the first interrogation, this was not a grill session of 48 straight hours or anything like that by the police. Although that first video is 5 hours long, a majority of that video is defendant sitting by himself. It was not a grill session by the police, even for those 5 hours. Notably, there's no request by defendant in that first interview to talk to anyone besides his girlfriend or make any phone calls. As to the phone, I think section 103-3 is in place to ensure that family and friends know where a defendant is, and a defendant has an opportunity to try to obtain counsel if that's his desire. It has nothing to do with a defendant allowed unfettered access to a smartphone, which is what I think defendant was really requesting. He says he wants his phone in the video. He doesn't say he wants to make a phone call. As we all know now, the smartphones are hardly used to primarily make telephone calls anymore. They're used for 24/7 access to the internet. There's no authority cited by defendant, nor can the state find authority that requires police to allow defendants to have smartphones at all times while they're incarcerated. So the phone, I think the record belies any attempt at saying that defendant wasn't allowed access to phone calls. He clearly was, as at least one was to his girlfriend. And there's nothing in the record to suggest that he wanted to make any more phone calls besides what he's requested. Contacting people by the phone, his family and friends were sufficiently apprised of his whereabouts. His girlfriend was there while he was being arrested. She knew he was being taken to the Springfield Police Department. We know that because she's there minutes after he tried to escape, and he gets to hug and kiss her in real time. As for the Xanax withdrawal, this was a finding of fact by the trial court. Therefore, it's entitled to the manifest weight of the evidence standard. We also have the benefit of the videos. I watched the videos. I'm sure your honors did too. Defendant's clearly communicating. He's answering all the questions. There's no, I mean, I think what counsel's position is that apparently he should have been given Xanax by the police. I don't know what the police would want to do in that situation. But this has nothing to do with the voluntariness of his confession, if in fact defendant was going through withdrawals for Xanax.
Well, I understood counsel to mean that this is one of the factors in looking at the totality of circumstances to determine whether or not the confession was voluntary. So if you combine the fact that he was going through withdrawal with withholding phone access, with being told that he had the key to getting his girlfriend out of jail, and the other factors opposing counsel mentioned, I think that was the point I understood.
As far as getting his girlfriend out of jail, there were no specific promises. And again, the benefit of the video to this, they ask him, and this was standard urges to cooperate by the detectives. In this case, it happens in most cases, they're urging him to tell the truth and to cooperate. That's not improper interrogation techniques, I would submit. Again,
excuse me, counsel, if I may, specifically on that, the second interview, when they make the statement, when you're done talking, and if you're honest, I don't have a problem with you calling her, referencing, I believe his mother. And then relatively quickly after that, he provides his first statement or confession, if you will. Doesn't that suggest, when you look at the totality of the circumstances, that statement did coerce him?
I think that, again, this is defendant's burden. It's we don't know. He was allowed to call his girlfriend. That's in the record beforehand. I don't know why. There's nothing to suggest that he wasn't allowed to call his mom too.
But during the second interview, he specifically asked, or Flynn testified, that the defendant asked to call his mother. And Flynn's response was, when you're done talking, and if you're honest, I don't have a problem with you calling her. Is that a specific promise from Flynn?
I mean, that's, again, just an urge to tell the truth. He just said, you're honest. He didn't say, tell us what we want to hear and you can call your mother. And again, I don't know. Maybe he's already been in contact with his mother. This is just during the interview. I don't know. And he might have called his mom prior to that, like he called his girlfriend. And I definitely don't think saying, if you are honest with us, you can make a phone call as any sort of specific promise, especially if we don't know if we're talking about, has defendant not called anybody? We know that's not true. He called his girlfriend. So he hasn't been incommunicado, as the standard says, at any point. And again, detective said at the beginning of the very second interview. Again, I think that was a little good cop, bad cop with the other one. I think he says, I want my phone at the beginning of that interview. I may be mistaken. And that's what I took to mean he wants access to his smartphone, not just to call his mother. But I looking at that, at the totality of the circumstances, I definitely don't think his will was overcome by the fact that the officer urged him to tell the truth.
With respect to the Krenkel hearing, did the trial court not have an obligation, once the issue of the corpus delicti was raised, to address it directly with the defendant?
No, they did not. The trial court, as it's well settled, the trial court can rely upon its own knowledge of the trial to accept or reject any Krenkel inquiry. The trial court didn't need any further input by defendant or counsel to dismiss probably the most absurd argument in a very long motion by defendant. Clearly, there was evidence of a crime presented at trial, so the trial court didn't need to go beyond its own knowledge to reject that very issue. It didn't need any other discussion by defendant, but of course defendant did talk about the sufficiency of the evidence, and I don't think the court sua sponte should have guided him to say any magic words during that Krenkel inquiry. And like I said, the trial court can rely upon its own knowledge. It doesn't need to talk to defendant or counsel to reject, to determine that an appointed counsel or counsel does not need to be appointed for that critical inquiry. I think that corpus delicti issue was rejected on its face, and correctly so. Harmless error as for the first issue, even assuming defendant's confession was invalid and assuming that the trial court or jury didn't even hear defendant's confession, the evidence against the defendant was overwhelming. Rosa pointed to defendant as the murderer. The jury heard that evidence. I know his trial testimony, you know, as it often does, contradicts that, but presumably the trial, the jury put more weight into the previous statement. Defendant admitted to Juan Reyes that he robbed and hurt someone on the day of the robbery and murder. And then defendant's undisputed actions after the murder showed his consciousness of guilt, took the victim's phone, destroyed evidence. And these are just the highlights. I mean, it was a very long trial, and there was overwhelming evidence, even disregarding defendant's confession. So it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, even assuming error for the confession argument. Sentencing, if you want to discuss that, the trial court specifically stated it considered, quote, the trial evidence, the pre-sentence investigation report, exhibits and additions and corrections, the history, character, and attitude of the defendant, the evidence and arguments, statement of allocution, considering all the factors in aggravation, the appropriate ones, and mitigation, and with due regard to the circumstances of the offense. As this court has stated many times, I'll quote it in Canizales Cardena in 2012, because that was my case. It's well settled that a trial court is not required to specify on the record the reason for a defendant's sentence. I've been before this court many times recently arguing that or facing an argument that the trial court considered improper factors. I don't blame this court one bit for just simply stating I considered the appropriate mitigation and aggravating factors and leaving it at that, to avoid that very argument on appeal that they considered an improper one.
How does that assist this court in reviewing the sentence? Generalities. How do the generalities assist this court as opposed to the specifics? And don't we have a little different situation when I believe it was on a motion to reconsider, the defendant specifically asked the court to articulate the reasons.
Yeah, that is true. The court just summarily denied the motion to reconsider.
Without stating any basis for this 80-year sentence.
They did state a basis. They stated they considered the appropriate aggravating and mitigating factors. Presumably, those were argued by defense counsel and the prosecutor during the recommendation phase. It considered the pre-sentence investigation report. It considered the trial evidence. It considered the nature and circumstances of the offense.
But we've got a double enhancement argument here. The trial court considered factors that were inherent in the offenses themselves. So how do we know what the trial court really considered without anything more than we have here? And how can we evaluate that?
Well, you evaluate it based on the, like I said, the arguments by counsel, both counsels, the PSI report, and the nature and circumstances of the offenses. That's quite a bit of material to base this sentence on. The double enhancement, I think, is a red herring. Alvarez pretty soundly defeats it, and I would submit that the Pascal case cited, it's an unpublished opinion, but it's directly on point as persuasive authority. Defendant robbing the victim and defendant killing the victim were two separate acts, two separate offenses. The legislature clearly intended, even if we want to call it double enhancement, this was legislature authorized double enhancement. The firearm enhancement adds an additional penalty to each criminal act. Clearly, armed robbery and murder have separate acts between them. And both of these enhancements were proper. So there was no improper double enhancement as far as that goes. If the trial court was specifically bare bones, I don't think it was an abuse of discretion in looking at the PSI report, looking at the nature and circumstances of the offense, looking at all the things that the trial court stated that it considered. This was not an abuse of discretion as far as this sentence was concerned. And unless the court has any other questions about any of the issues, I'll take them, or I will ask this court to affirm.
Okay, I see no questions. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll be brief here. First, the opposing counsel had the suggestion that Trujillo needed to be in a high-risk cell because he was because of this escape attempt and because he was a suicide risk after he begged the officers to murder him. But that he was actually released by medical from the high-risk cell, and the hold was exclusively because of administrative purposes. And the state didn't provide any justification of how he was any more of a risk of escaping from a high-risk cell than if he would be just in the general population. The opposing counsel also mentioned Miranda warnings, but I think it's important here that the Miranda warnings, especially during the second interrogation, were almost used as a penalty. He was told he specifically asked if he requested attorney, would he return to this high-risk cell that he'd been in for 36 hours without seeing anybody, and the detectives told him yes. So if he would have requested attorney, he would just go back to this indefinite isolation. Now he did request to speak with the detectives on the 25th, March 25th. Counsel mentioned that. But I think this just reinforces the involuntariness of his statement, because the only reason he requested to speak with the detectives is because they weren't honoring their end of the bargain, and that was to provide phone access. And so because they weren't providing phone access, he asked to speak with the detectives again. And I don't think there's any evidence here that he specifically wanted that Mr. Trujillo wanted his own cell phone or smartphone specifically. A review of the record makes it clear he was just desperate to talk with his family. He spoke with his mother and brother every day. He very clearly wanted to see his girlfriend or speak to her in whatever manner he could. And so there isn't any claim here that this was related specifically to a cell phone. The counsel also mentioned that the evidence was overwhelming because of Juan Reyes's testimony. I just want to briefly address that. His testimony, he was an acquaintance of Trujillo, but his testimony was very vague, and just that Trujillo showed up to his apartment in the shooting's aftermath and said something about a robbery, and that he may have hurt someone. But there's no indication that he was confessing to actually committing a robbery of anyone, much less Mr. Poole. And just thinking about a robbery could be equally probative that he was worried that he was going to be blamed of a robbery. And that was his trial testimony, that which also explains the consciousness of guilt evidence that the state provided, that he was worried he was going to be blamed for this shooting and that he'd be unable to prove his claim of self-defense. And regarding the sentencing issue, I do briefly want to address that. Here, the state clearly made improper arguments during its sentencing arguments, and it's impossible for this court to determine whether or not the circuit court credited them or not without the circuit court explaining if it considered those factors. And that's especially important here, where defense counsel wasn't silent on the issue and raised it in a motion to reconsider, and that was the first opportunity it had to raise the issue after the circuit court made its ruling. And I believe I'm about out of time. So unless there are any other questions.
Don't see any.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll stand in recess.